From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, we present the first of three installments from the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled, In the Bible, A Judge Named Deborah. Introducing Professor Wiesel is Boston University President Emeritus John Silber.
34 years ago, I introduced this annual series of three lectures by Elie Wiesel. His lecture tonight will be the 100th in this series. It is interesting to recall what has happened in the 34 intervening years since Professor Wiesel first spoke to this series. During these years, Elie has written approximately 40, or maybe 45, additional books. He has also won the Nobel Peace Prize and established the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity, which has addressed urgent moral issues, the etiology of hatred, and threats to world peace. In these intervening years, he has been knighted by the Queen of England, awarded the United States Congressional Gold Medal, the Medal of Liberty, as well as the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He has also received the French Legion d'Honneur. In many ways, most important, he has been confidant and advisor to several of our presidents, most especially to Ronald Reagan, and most recently to Barack Obama. A few months ago, he was honored when an astronomer named a newly discovered planet in his honor. In these years, Elie Wiesel has made it his primary concern to arouse the consciousness of mankind to the realities of the Holocaust. He has achieved this effect through his writings, his speeches, and the conferences he has developed. The single and most important contribution he has made is, I believe, in the publication of Night, now a classic translated into 30 or more foreign languages and read by many millions of students, many millions, throughout the world. In Night, he revealed the full horror of the Holocaust as an inscrutable evil. The horror of this expression of human nature is beyond rational explanation and comprehension. He has left it to madmen to make sense of it and has asked the pointed question, where was God? Wiesel's book, Night, has made millions of young students aware of this tragedy in which all standards of civilization were abandoned. I offer as an example of Wiesel's influence on generations of young people the following words by a 13-year-old student who wrote them after she had read Night. Her class was assigned a report on the Holocaust based on Anne Frank's diary and other books. But on her own, she supplemented her reading list by adding Night and wrote then as follows. And I quote her, 13 years old. Then the class began the Holocaust unit, and I was fascinated. I found it truly interesting as well as sick and gruesome. I actually put heart into my essay. I realized how personal it could become because I cared about what happened, because it wasn't some book that had no connections to the real world. Anne Frank was real. Elie Wiesel is real. Those thousands of dead Jews were real. That is why I cared. This really happened, and I couldn't begin to imagine the pain these people went through. She writes, the truck rattles through the cracks in the boards. Children, mothers, fathers, all of them can feel the cold night's wind come through the desolate land to chill them. They huddle together. The stench of urine is intolerable. A child begins to wail. And there are many tear-filled faces etched with fear. The truck stops. Reflecting on her own words, she added, "This is the most powerful response I have ever written. I wanted to capture what the Jews must have experienced during one of the many persecutions against them. I was humbled when I was taught the full extent of Hitler's wrath, and I hoped to humble others, to let the pure souls of the innocent fly free and spread a message of peace. I believe this young student exemplifies the experience of many millions of students who have read Night. In this book, Wiesel seared the consciousness of mankind with the concrete reality of this horror. He's helped all of us see what the Holocaust revealed about human nature. Denial or indifference to this tragedy is simply unacceptable. And because of Wiesel's work, denial and indifference have been largely overcome. I know no one else who has so thoroughly altered the moral consciousness of his generation throughout the world as Elie Wiesel. Tonight, we welcome Elie Wiesel again to this platform. This time, he will speak on Deborah, a judge of Israel before the kingship was established. You will see that nearly 1,000 years ago, Israelis recognized the leadership potential of women and were pleased to be beneficiaries of their leadership. Deborah, Yael, Judith, Esther, and others exemplify the special contributions of women to the preservation of the people of Israel. It is with anticipation that for the 100th time, we await the words of Professor Wiesel.
For the 100th time, thank you, Dr. Silver. As always, we are grateful. I am. Well, tonight is a story about three women. The first is a judge in ancient Israel, a prophet who communicates God's words, a charismatic religious and undisputed political leader. But she also is a military advisor who is behind a general's strategic plans against powerful enemies. Yes, a great woman she was, one among the 18 judges that at that time ruled over Israel. And her name is Deborah. Deborah, says a text, quote, who would sit under the palm tree between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim. Her dramatic life story is to be found in the book of Judges. And it is being read on the Sabbath, when its haftarah, or prophetic portion, is devoted to her song, the song of Deborah. For she was also a talented and inspired poet. Her victory poem ranks among the most poignant in our sacred texts. It may also be read as a historical document about Israel's situation at that time, who the enemy was, what his strength was, which tribe went to war to fight him, and which chose to stay behind, neutral. And all this happened 3,000 years ago. Naturally, men also took part, and of course, sometimes a major part in the fighting. But she, Deborah, and another woman of whom we shall speak about later, played a crucial role in the outcome of the battle. In fact, some sources attribute to her Israel's stunning military triumph. Mind you, she is not the only great and renowned feminine figure in biblical and Talmudic history. Following the matriarchs were Moses' sister Miriam, who galvanized and mobilized women. She is the first woman organizer in Jewish history. And there is Esther, who saved her people in Persia. There is Bruria, the great Talmudic scholar, who through the fear of heaven in these scholars when she met them in the street. But she, Deborah, alone was appointed by God to be his messenger and spokesperson. She knew what to do, how to do it, and when to do it. But who was she? Where did she come from? Who were her parents? And what was her childhood? We do not know. Who were her teachers, her mentors? We do not know. Did she have children? Was she at all married? How old was she when she acquired her talent and great powers? And when she led her people, our people, to war? We do not know. There are many things, vital elements about her biography that remain hidden. All we know is what we learn from the text. Again, it's called in the text, in the book of Judges. There she is called Eshet Lapidot, which would mean a woman of a place named Lapidot, or the wife of a man bearing that name. Lapid in Hebrew means a torch. In other words, it suggests fire and flame. Are we then to imagine Deborah a woman with a burning inner life, a strong character, an irresistible passion, or someone who quietly but with resolve inspired others to action? I repeat and I insist, we do know little about her private life, but we know much more about her public activities. And to understand her better, it would be important to situate her in place and time. Joshua just died. He was 110 years old. We are told that his funeral was inexplicably poorly attended. The Talmud says so. He was buried in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gash. Gash means trembling or even earthquake. Was the mountain angry, wonders the Talmud. Why was the mountain angry? And the Talmud answers, because no one came to pay a last homage to Moses' successor. The heroic conqueror who brought them in the land of Canaan was abandoned in his death. Not strange to accompany a person to his grave is one of the 10 most important humane mitzvot or commandments in our tradition. And yet Joshua's contemporaries violated or ignored it. How come? How ungrateful were his contemporaries? And the Talmud says, actually, why didn't they come? They were too busy. Too busy with their daily occupations. No wonder that, let's read from the book, quote, a new generation arose which did not know the Lord, nor what he has done for Israel. Then, says the text, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and worshipped the idol of Baal. They forsook the Lord God of their fathers, provoking his anger. Remember, the land promised by God to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Moses, and to their descendants was practically in their hands, but they had no leadership. Joshua left them without appointing a successor. Every tribe had a chieftain with an authority limited to its allotted territory. God was neglected, history forgotten. The idols Baal and Ashtaroth became popular and attractive again. So God became angry, and says the text, he delivered them into the hands of plunderers who oppressed them in many ways. Some were sold as captives to their enemies. The nation fell close to abyss. The Lord did raise up judges to rescue his people, but they wouldn't listen to them. History moved forward in circles. Sin and punishment followed one another to such a degree that God declared, I will no longer drive out any of the nations which Joshua left when he died. In other words, you better do it yourselves. The Hebrews were forced to fight. Now, was it a punishment? The text says so. It was also a way of teaching future generations how to wage war. So were the nations of Israel had to confront. Who were they? The Philistines, the Canaanites, the Sidonites, and the Hivites. The first judge was a man named Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. He fought and won, and there was peace in the land for 40 years. When he died, the children of Israel resumed their mischief, which strengthened the Moabites to persecute them. The next judge was Ehud, son of Gera, of the tribe of Benjamin, a man of courage and skill. He came to visit King Eglon of Moab, allegedly to offer him a tribute, but he also hid a double-edged dagger in his clothes. With clever stratagems, he managed to be alone with him and kill him. A war erupted between Moab and Israel. Ehud's army won. 10,000 Moabites fell in battle. The land rested 80 years now. Shamgar, son of Anat, succeeded Ehud. His troops killed 600 Philistines. Again, as they did before in periods of calm, the children of Israel continued to transgress the law of God, who taught them an old new lessons. Superficial joy brought danger, and this time by the Canaanite king Yavin, who ruled in Hazor. Then arose the prophetess Deborah as judge over her sinful people. My God, what is the story of the Jewish people? Sin and punishment. More sin, more punishment, again and again. Will it ever end, was the question then. But at this point, of course, as we begin yet really another series of our annual encounters, we should follow our tradition and just open preliminary remarks. The objective of these learning sessions together remains the same. Explore the extraordinary riches of ancient texts and at times analyze their impact on contemporary issues and experiences. We have throughout the years that what excited another or intrigued sages in disciples in Palestinian academies. At that time, the term Palestine had no political or Muslim or Arab connotation. You said Palestine, it meant Judea. And therefore, whatever happened then has an impact on our lives today. Each time a question is raised and an innovation is made, it enhances the beauty of the team before us. And that was, of course, the case when they studied here the tales, legends, and laws of Abraham and Moses, Samson and Samuel. And that happens now when we turn to Deborah, a great figure in Jewish history, a very powerful woman, who, sitting under a tree, had to make vital decisions regarding Jewish destiny. One can almost imagine her. Back to the amazing book before us. Read it carefully, and you will remember that the period of the Judges was not the most luminous chapter of our people's turbulent and proud history. No wonder its opening verse is by a he be mot shoftim. It happened at a time when even the judges were judged. But as in the anecdote of the two brothers, the people were worse. The people were Jewish and faithful only when things were going poorly, when the enemy was mighty and Jews were spiritually weak, forlorn, easily seduced by alien idols. Then they returned to God because they needed him. They needed his divine intervention. Has it always been that way? Is it still like that? Are we Jewish only when we suffer being Jewish? Are we Jewish only when the outside pressures are there? In other words, almost to quote a French philosopher, are we Jewish because the anti-Semite sees us as Jews? When the outside pressures are gone, some people believe, our Jewish identity and solidarity weakened by excessive integration or assimilation, leading even to conversion, as was the case in Austria, Germany, and Hungary in the early 1900s. Is the French proverb correct that plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, the more things change, the more they stay the same? Isn't it conceivable that on a certain level, the Jewish people is still following Abraham to Mount Moriah, Joshua to the River Jordan, and Jeremiah to the ruins of and in Jerusalem? Will the history of Israel forever be threatened, if not by the same fiend, then at least by the same kind of enemy using various methods? Where is the answer to its old and new existential questions? Those that already in the time of the judges acquired such a sense of urgency. Well, who is Deborah? What made her so courageous, so famous, so revered? Granting at that time, with the passing of the last titanic figure, Joshua, the people of Israel needed someone to respect and to follow. But why she? Because she was elected to God. Did they care that much about God to respect his envoy? Consider again the situation. Israel had no kings yet, the enemies had. And the latest one was King Yavin of Hazor. He and his top general, Sisera, were mighty, well-armed, and probably motivated properly. We know quite a lot today about all of them. Some people believe today that Sisera actually came from Sardinia. They even found one of his chariots to this day. At that time, the Canaanite armies were equipped with 900 chariots of iron, and they all seemed invincible. Yavin's expression, King Yavin's expression of Israel, which lasted Yavin's oppression of Israel, which lasted 20 years, represented a real threat to the land and to the descendants of Jacob. The threat was also moral and spiritual. The people of Israel must have learned from experience. Whenever the enemy was in power, it was because God, the God of their ancestors, had placed him there. And the text says so specifically. It was God who made the enemy strong and victorious. Because of whom? Because the enemy was so good? No. Because the Hebrews or the Jews were so bad. They disappointed him, and so despair was not far away. Now I know, whatever I said now about the text then, if it has implications for today, then it's very serious. Are we to believe that whenever the enemy was strong in the 20th century, it was God's will? Were we really so bad, so sinful? Have we done such terrible things that God had to show his displeasure by giving might to the enemy of the Jewish people and to the enemy of humankind? We always have the same enemy. Then we were lucky, because then came Deborah. The great Louis Ginsburg quotes the following midrash. When the people of Israel fell off from God and his law, God sent an angel to them with the following message. Out of all the nations on earth, I chose a people for myself, and I thought, so long as the world stands, my glory will rest upon them. I sent to them Moses, my servant, to teach them goodness and righteousness, but they strayed from my ways. And now I will arouse their enemies against them, to rule over them, and they will cry out, because we forsook the ways of our fathers, this misfortune came over us. But then I will send a woman unto them, and she will shine for them as a light for 40 years. Deborah's first political and military move was wise and useful. Though she belonged to the tribe of Ephraim, she called upon a warrior from the Naphtali tribe, Barak, son of Abinoam, and she appointed him as commander-in-chief. Her goal, to unite the people. That was her first goal, her first move. She wanted, actually, the people to rise immediately above tribal loyalties and sensitivities because the enemy was so powerful. Now, Deborah is not the only woman prophet in biblical literature. The number was 58. 58 and 8 were women. Of course, there was one, we said it before her, and her name was Miriam. Remember, the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea in total safety. Led by Moses, they sang a famous song of gratitude to God. And Miriam, together with all other women, followed with a very brief song of their own. Which I love to think that women are always more concise than men. And she said, I shall sing to God. Said Moses, Ashira Ladoshem. Miriam said, Shiru Ladoshem, sing to God. As for Deborah, her song, composed jointly with the Jewish commander-in-chief, is a song of praise devoted to Israel's military victory, obtained by a courageous and imaginative woman, the second woman in this story, named Yael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite, who with supreme cunning and self-confidence, without anyone's orders, helped General Barak, son of Abinoam, defeat the commander of the enemy army, Sisera. Now, the entire story of that event is actually told in two places in the book of Judges. But the question is, who wrote it? One text says that she wrote it herself. Is it possible that she would boast about her own glory? I doubt it. But nevertheless, some people believe so, and I have the duty to repeat what they said. But the fact is also, the book of Judges, which contains that poem, is beautiful. The song is prose and in poetry. And what follows is an amazing dialogue between a powerful soldier and an unarmed woman. The opening is abrupt. Without any political or strategic preparation, quote, "She sent for Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in the tribe of Naphtali, and said to him, 'Has not the Lord God of Israel commanded you to go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor and take with you 10,000 men of the tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun?'" Actually, there is no previous trace of such an order in the text. Obviously, it means that Barak has not obeyed God's commandment, and that God has therefore felt that it is important, necessary, to alert his prophetic female messenger to repeat it to the general, which continues. Now, why hasn't Barak obeyed God's will? Why did he wait for her? Text continues. And she said, "Hasn't God told him that against you I will send Sisera, the chief of Yavin's army, with his chariots and his forces at the river of Kishon, and that I will deliver him into your hands?" Said Deborah to Barak. And finally, who until now doesn't answer at all, doesn't say a word, maybe he said, "Oh, a woman talking." But then he says something stunning. He said, quote, "If you go with me, I will go with you. But if you will not go with me, I will not go either." An ultimatum. Barak, son Avinoah, the commander-in-chief, a weakling, a coward afraid of the challenges and perils of battlefields, and he needs a woman to be with him? Possible. In fact, he is ready to withdraw into himself and abandon Israel's history to the enemy. He said so. "If you don't come with me, I will leave the battlefield." Why then is he ready to yield to God's design for him and his people in spite of everything? Only because Deborah will be with him? Is it that he admires his position of authority? Is he taken by her social status? Is he perhaps taken by her femininity? One source identifies him as her husband. Now, a husband, I would understand. Why should a husband listen to his wife? But he believes in her, it's clear. Since he joins his destiny to hers, does he hope to obtain some kind of glory in their common victory? She will immediately negate all such illusions. And she says, "I will certainly go with you," she says to him. "Nevertheless, do not expect any glory from our journey, for the Lord will give Sisera in the hand of a woman." In other words, not in his hands, in the hands of a woman. And perhaps he saw that she referred to herself. Nonetheless, he accepted, and the two of them rose and went to Kadesh to war. Let's stop for a moment and see again the role women played in biblical history. Were they all dominant figures? Some surely were. The most prominent one was our grandmother Eve. Adam was almost a tool in her hands. What she told him to do, he did. He wasn't hungry, but she made him eat. When they had children, it was she who named them, as if he had nothing to do with the act of giving life. Among the four matriarchs, Rebecca was the decision maker in the family. And since Jacob was her favorite, she lured her husband into giving him Esau's birthright. It was she who made Jacob to go to her uncle and get married. All the time, women actually were those who made decisions. What about Rahab, the famous Rahab, the all-knowing woman in Jericho, who by profession is worth to be known, paid to be known. And she imposes herself as a heroic figure. At the risk of her life, she sheltered Joshua's spies and helped him conquer the land of Canaan. And according to the legend, she became his wife. Whenever we have situations like this, right away we marry them. And what about Esther? How could we forget Mordechai's niece, who thanks to her beauty and devotion saved the entire Jewish population of Persian King Ahasuerus' 127 provinces? Her lessons: there can be beauty in morality, and the other way around. And what about Ruth? How can we forget this gentle and timid young woman who incarnates the very principle of loyalty? What she told her mother-in-law, Naomi, still repeated by any woman who wishes to convert to Judaism: wherever you go, I shall go. Wherever you shall dwell, I shall dwell. Where you die and rest, I shall. The Messiah, the Redeemer of Israel and the world, will be her distant offspring. Why do we know more about her than about Deborah, the prophetess, who during her life saved her people from bondage, if not annihilation? But let's beware of generalization. Not all women in biblical history were good and God-fearing. King Ahab's wife, for instance, Queen Jezebel, Prophet Elijah's hateful enemy, was evil personified. Many innocent lives were lost under her reign. Many abominations were committed for her pleasure. And much is known about all of them, much more than about Deborah. Again, about Deborah. In fact, surprisingly little, so little, is known about her life, except about that period when she had to defeat Israel's enemies. What do we know? Clearly, she had the quality of leadership in three public areas. In religious terms, she was a prophetess. In the social sphere, she was a judge. In security matters, she had a commanding position in the battlefield. What about her private life? We presume that she was married to a man named Lapidot, but little is known about him or about their married life. Who was in charge of the household? Who took care of the children if they had any? What was the husband doing while she was away, doing communal work? What was his trade, his livelihood? What were his moods, his ambitions? How did he feel being married to a public personality more famous than he? And she, was she attractive? Was she seductive? Was she really feminine? We are told to know that she is a mother. I rose a mother in Israel, she sings in her song. But not of how many children, or whether she was really a mother or she used it poetically. I'm a mother of Israel. Many references to Deborah in the Midrash are praiseworthy. In one place, some sages believe that Deborah's husband Lapidot was an ignoramus. And one day she told him, "Let's go together to the holy temple in Jerusalem. I shall make candles with thick wicks to bring light to good and pious people in darkness, and so you shall earn a place in the world to come." Said God, "Since you sincerely brought light in this world, I shall increase your light, which will have the intensity of that of all the tribes of Israel." Now, of course, we know much more about her extraordinary spiritual role in defeating Sisera's mighty armies. Not only did she transmit God's orders to Barak, son of Abinoam, to go to war, she also accepted to join him at the front, something she did without asking for heavenly consent or even for her husband's consent. Furthermore, she went as far as to tell Barak when to launch the attack, which, by the way, throws a strange light on the young commanding officer. In his relationship with Deborah, he does not fare too well, too hesitant, too recalcitrant, too obedient. Can we imagine today a general in Israel who refuses to go to the front unless in the company of a woman? Now, who was Barak? In some Midrashic sources, he figures among the judges, alongside Deborah, with equal rights and functions. Like her, he was a judge, perhaps even a good one. But he was not a prophet. Prophecy belonged to her, just as military strategy and bravery ultimately belonged to him. Is his hesitation due to the fact that he received the direct battle orders from her and not from God? That actually God used Deborah as his messenger to him? But on the other hand, we may phrase this question differently. Didn't God use only Deborah because of Barak's hesitations? Is this why he was punished? And his punishment being that at the end of the story, at the end of the battle, victory will be obtained not by him, but a woman. Now, actually, one Midrashic source is critical of Deborah. You know, that is so marvelous about our text. There is always a critical point. To have an agreement of admiration is impossible. First, because we are told that she summoned Barak to come to see her instead of going to see him. Now, this is a criticism. Why should she go to him? He could come to her. Furthermore, we must know that in doing that, precious time was wasted for the orders to come and go. When there is a crisis, every minute counts. Another hidden reproach: she sounds vain when she claims that things were going badly in the land until she, Deborah, a mother in Israel, rose to save her people. And her punishment, says the Midrash, her prophetic powers were taken away from her temporarily. And that's, of course, the singular virtue of our sacred texts. No one is totally pure, nor totally innocent. Even the greatest, Abraham, Moses, David, and Deborah, have their shortcomings, their faults. Sages also wonder, why was she really chosen to deliver God's message to Barak, since Pinchas, son of Eleazar, Aaron the high priest's grandson, was still alive? Both had prophetic powers. Still, says the Midrash, there was a difference between them. Pinchas' powers were hereditary, whereas Deborah's were her own, meaning they were given to her thanks to her own virtues. Commented the Midrash Tanah de Bei Eliyahu, God said, "Heaven and earth are my witnesses, whether Gentile or Jew, man or woman, slave or servant, the Holy Spirit rests on him or her only according to their good deeds." And now let's turn to another important protagonist in the story, the principal enemy, Sisera. Who is he? In the biblical text, he is a famous Canaanite warrior whose 900 chariots of iron and numerous soldiers threw fear and terror into the hearts of adversaries. As usual, the Midrash, with its occasional taste for exaggerations, goes much farther. using imagination and color to depict Sisera's appearance and behavior. Listen. Listen to the portrait of the Canaanite Superman as it is to be found in the Midrash Abu Gurion and Yalkut Shimoni. Quote, "There was no hero like him. He had 40,000 army chiefs under his command, and each of them had 100,000 men at his disposal. He was 30 when he conquered the entire world with his physical strength. No city was safe. His voice alone made its walls collapse. It paralyzed beasts in the field. When he went to war, he rode in a wagon drawn by 900 horses. He cut his ironclad enemies into pieces like wool." More? Listen. "The proportions of his body were vast beyond description. If he took a bath in the river and dived beneath the surface, enough fish were caught in his beard to feed a multitude of people. Furthermore, during the 20 years of his brutal domination over Israel, he was not satisfied with physical oppression alone. He ridiculed and humiliated the people, inflicting on them ever more mental and psychological suffering," says the Midrash. "It is because of this added cruelty that he was punished. His punishment," again repeat, something very important there in those times, "that in the end he perished in the hand of a woman." The disturbing impression one gets from these words is that they imply a distinct measure of disdain towards Sisera. Not only was he to be slain, but in addition to his tragic fate, he will be killed by a woman. What's the difference how one dies? But in other words, we are told there, in those times, to suffer defeat is bad. To suffer defeat by a woman is worse. Now, several Midrashic sources use this tale, do not be shocked, to stress the woman's inferiority in certain areas. Rabbi Berachia uttered four sentences, three about men and one about women. "Woe to the living man who needs a dead for help. Woe to the strong who need the weak. Woe to the clever person who needs a blind man. And woe to the generation whose leader is a woman." Wow. In another source, we find the phrase, "Vayehi shofetet et Israel be'et ahi," and she judged Israel at that time. It means in reality that the times were almost unworthy of male leadership. Well, some of you, surely many of you here, may feel hurt or insulted by this seemingly Talmudic anti-feminine insensitivity, which may be termed today as gender discrimination. I join you. I am a great enemy of humiliation. Those of you familiar with Jewish prayers must have wondered whether we men are not really kind and fair to women when we say every morning, Baruch Shalom Asani Isha, blessed be thou for not having made me a woman. And one explanation I received from a Jerusalem rabbi, a friend, sounded appealing to me. He said it has to do with childbirth. We men thank God that we do not have children to go to. He said to me that when I heard my wife for the first time giving birth and the pain she endured, then I understood the blessing. One day I hope we may devote our entire session to the place of women in Judaism. I'm ready to do it. For the moment, let us just say that it is more respectful than it may seem at first sight. Let me give you one example. Why is the Jewishness of the Jew determined by his or her mother alone? Because in those times of anguish and persecution under the Roman occupation of Judea, some women were raped by Roman soldiers. and became pregnant. So our sages decided, why inflict upon these poor women an additional plight and shame of thinking that they are carrying an enemy child in their womb? Let the child be Jewish. And this I admire. Though there is something which again, in the beginning, we are told that when God said to Adam and Eve, "Hu yimshol bach," and he will rule over you. I know it's terrible because that means that we men should always rule over women. No. I think the "Hu yimshol bach," yimshol comes from the word mashal, a parable. The "Hu yimshol bach," he will be a parable to you. That I prefer. Anyway, let's return to the story of Deborah and Sisera. The Canaanites lost, the Jews won. But whose victory was it? Deborah's? No. Barak's? No. It was due now to another woman. Another woman whom Deborah made famous. Now, who is that strange and until then unknown woman who is the second woman in our story? Was she a soldier? No. She was just a simple housewife. How did she win the war? Wait, be patient. Actually, she entered the stage after the battle was already over. Who is to be thanked for Israel's victory? The army? No. Did they fight valiantly with renewed vigor? Let's read the biblical narrative. Sisera mobilized all his people from Haroshet Hagoyim to the river Kishon. Then Deborah said to Barak, "Get up. This is the day in which God had delivered Sisera into your hand. Has not God gone out before you?" So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. And God routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his troops with the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. What? Not Barak, son of Abinoam, but God himself inflicted bloody defeat unto the enemy forces? It was God's intervention and not Jewish heroism that brought fear and death among the enemy's troops? It came only when the entire people joined in a public seven-day fast and repentance that God forgave and acted. Is it that in the life of individuals as well as in the history of people, God's will is manifested through human endeavor, which may be one of frailty? Suddenly the plot changes direction and characters. Let's return to the text. But Sisera had fled the battlefield. He alone survived. The commander-in-chief of the army survived. And he fled the battlefield and reached the tent of Yael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Well, where are we now? The war is over. Gone the Canaanites. Israel can breathe easier. God made peace with his people. Deborah is happy, as Barak must be. Sisera is not among the casualties. So what? Alone and solitary, he is no threat to anyone. So the story could end right here, but it doesn't. It continues in two places, in prose and in Deborah's poem. And it reads like a classical movie with at the center not James Bond, but listen. I quote, "And Yael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, 'Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, do not fear.'" End of quote. And when he turned aside into her tent, she covered him with the blanket. And then he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, I am thirsty." Questions. She went out to meet him. Has he met her before? Has she known him? Who told her to go out and meet him? Was it part of Deborah's or Barak's strategic plan? One Midrashic source says that she was unusually beautiful, quote, "whose voice was the most seductive a woman ever possessed." Quote, "Yael opened a jug of milk, gave him a drink, and covered him. And he said to her, "Stand at the door of the tent, and if any man comes and inquires of you and asks, 'Is there a man here?' you shall say no." Rashi wonders, why did she give him milk? Because milk has a soporific effect on the body. It helps it put to sleep. Then, says the text, Yael, Heber's wife, took a peg and took a hammer in her hand and came softly near him and drove the peg into his temple, and it went down into the ground, for he was fast asleep and tired. So he died. And then, says the text, as Barak pursued Sisera, Yael came out to greet him and said to him, "Come, I will show you the man you seek." And when he went inside the tent, there lay Sisera dead with a peg in his temple. Thus on that day, God subdued Yavin, king of Canaan, in the presence of the children of Israel. Yael, the heroine. Yael, the victor. Yael, the repository of feminine glory, but also of duplicity. And this chapter in the book of Judges contains surprising elements. Why is it there? The brutality of Yael. There was one man left. What could he do? And why did she kill him like that? Canaan really was no longer a threat to Israel, since the entire army was annihilated. So why did his chief warrior had to die? He was not, as Agag will be under King Saul, of the Amalekite tribe. Why couldn't he be spared, even imprisoned, or let him go underground? Furthermore, who was Yael? Who was her commanding officer? Who trained her? Concerning the war itself, the text attributes its outcome to divine intervention. It is God who helped Barak and his forces to defeat the Canaanites. It was God who subdued King Yabin of Canaan. But was God also in Yael's tent? Was God helping her murder Sisera? Had God told her to murder Sisera? Is God the eternal matchmaker who arranged their encounter, which ended in his death? I admit it. This part of the tale perturbs me. Of all places to hide, why did Sisera come particularly to Yael's tent? Actually, the biblical text offers an immediate explanation. For there was a peace treaty between the Canaanite king Yavin of Hazor and the whole house of Heber the Kenite. Really? Is that a valid explanation? Wait a second. Does it mean that Heber the Kenite was not Jewish? Was Yael the righteous, so celebrated by Deborah, as we shall see later, married to a pagan? Naturally, it's also possible that Heber was Jewish, but then how could he and his family live in peace with the Canaanite occupation regime? Yes, I am puzzled by this episode. Luckily, I am not the only one. Midrashi commentators and there seem to have shared my puzzlement. The great Don Yitzchak Abrabanel, one of my favorite medieval philosophers and commentators, asks himself about the real nature of the relationship between the king of Hazor and the Kenite family. It must have been close, otherwise Sisera would not have turned to it for shelter. But if that was the case, if Sisera came to the Kenite tent because she trusted the family of Heber, is it humanly conceivable that Yael violated that trust? One theory indicated by Abrabanel based on the Midrashic hypothesis is that the covenant between the two communities signed by man applied to man only. In other words, Yael did not feel obligated to fully respect its terms. It was signed by man. Another theory identifies her with Jethro, Moses' father-in-law. He too was a Kenite who joined the people of Israel. Just as Jethro was known for the warm hospitality he showed Moses, the fugitive from Pharaoh, she, Yael, welcomed Sisera, the fugitive from Barak. In other words, according to the Midrash, mitzvot, or divine commandments, too are hereditary. Yael inherited the virtue of hospitality from Jethro. What? This is hospitality? Is it possible that the story has some erotic connotations? Some sages stress the seductive aspect of the scene. Rabbi Yochanan interprets the words, quote, he fell between her legs as an affirmation. Quote, on that day, says he, Sisera committed 7 sexual violations of acts of rape on Yael. One source believes the milk she gave him to drink was a woman's. Others negate such possibilities. And referring to Yael's covering Sisera with a blanket, says Resh Lakish, we studied the entire scripture and did not find a single object called smicha, which means blanket. What is smicha? A composition of 2 syllables. Smicha, my name is testimony. That wicked man, Sisera, is testimony that he did not even touch her. So she remained pure. From the purely human viewpoint, Yael does not come off too nobly in this episode. A defenseless fugitive arrives seeking shelter, compassion and pity and life from someone who was supposed to be friendly. And what does he get? False charity and real brutality. Yet most sages follow Deborah's position and see in Yael a heroic figure whose sole purpose was to save her people. Our sages go as far as ranking Yael alongside the 4 matriarchs, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, who, like her, were pious and pure in all their behavior. The biblical narrative ends with what is called the Song of Deborah. Although in the text we include the name of Barak as co-author, the Talmud compares it in its grandeur and magnitude to the song of Moses at the crossing of the Red Sea. In both cases, the faith of Israel weakened, causing God's miraculous intervention. What? Again, Israel's faith weakened? When did it weaken? Hasn't he defeated the powerful enemy? Answers the Talmud, it weakened before the battle even began. Sisera's army must have seemed invincible to the Jews, who for the last 20 years had endured pain, fear, and discouraging pessimism. And to pull them out of the state of depression, God performed miracles by fighting with them, for them, just as he had done at the Red Sea. Says Rav Chuna in the Talmud, it is written in Ashamayim Nilchamu HaKochavim, the stars in heaven joined in the battle. It means, Sisera planned his battle plans studying the stars. So God moved them around and confused his calculations. Also, as Sisera advanced his troops to cross the river Kishon, God ordered it to become a trap. They drowned, and Sisera fled before the victorious repenting children of Israel. And Deborah's accomplishment was thus not military but religious. She made them aware of their sins and their implacable punishment they won only when they repented. And now in conclusion, let us listen to Deborah's and Barak's victory song. When leaders lead in Israel, when the people willingly offer themselves, bless the Lord. Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes, I will sing to the Lord. When you went out of Seir, when you marched in the field of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens poured, the clouds also poured water, the mountains gushed before the Lord God of Israel. And following the description of miracles, she turns to reality when the highways were deserted and the wanderers walked along sideways. Village life ceased. It ceased in Israel until I arose. arouse a mother in Israel. Is she in ecstasy? Listen. Awake, awake, Deborah. Awake, sing a song. Barak, lead your captives away, O son of Abinoam. And then the survivors came down, the people against the dignitaries. The Lord came down for me against the mighty. And she describes the tribes that joined forces against the enemy and those that didn't. And then comes the magnificent, pathetic, and surprisingly vengeful denouement. She describes Sisera's downfall. Listen. At her feet he sank, he fell, he lay still. At her feet he sank, he fell. Where he sank, there he fell dead. And suddenly, she changes the optical attention from Sisera to his mother. And we are now about the third woman in the story. Quote, the mother of Sisera looked through the window and cried out through the lattice, why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tatters the clatter of his chariots? Her wisest ladies answered her, or maybe she answered herself, are they not finding and dividing the spoil? That's why they are late. To every man a girl or two. For Sisera, plunder of dyed garments, plunder of garments embroidered and dyed. 2 pieces of dyed embroidery for the neck of the looter. Thus, says Deborah, let all your enemies perish, O Lord. Cain yovdu ovecha Israel. But let those who love him be like the sun when it comes out in full strength. And so the land, says the text, had rest for 40 years. And her last words in the Midrash is an exhortation to the people not to rely on the dead. Only the living pray. Prayer alone can change events. End of the chapter. But I cannot erase the image of Sisera's mother standing at a window, waiting for her dead son. And every year, when I chant the Haftarah, the portion of the prophets which contains this episode, it is always the Parshav B'Shalach. I chant it because it's the yahrzeit for my father, Shlomo ben Eliezer Halevi. It falls the following week on the 18th day of Shvat. Yes, each time I chant the song of Deborah, and when I reached its climax with Sisera's mother's anguish, my voice is halted, penetrated by melancholy. Why was she made to suffer? What had she done to deserve such punishment? If the son was a looter, was it her fault? And why did Deborah feel it necessary or even meaningful to tell her story? The story of a mother whose tears were waiting to be shed. Wasn't she herself a mother? Is the story on the mysterious level nothing of what in time of warfare and bloodshed, invisibly and imperceptibly, always links one mother to another, one human being to others? Isn't war always a tragedy for all mothers? Was Deborah so insensitive to the suffering of a woman who was not Jewish, be she the mother of a cruel, implacable enemy? I don't think so. Is it, on the contrary, to her credit that she told the story of the mother? For what about us, fellow learners and friends here? Do we aspire to follow Yael's example or Deborah's example to remember the mothers? Is this our mission? If we, here and elsewhere, are to draw a lesson from such biblical memories of lofty dreams and fearful nightmares as those that we learned about the time of Deborah. If we are here to learn a lesson. The question is, what is the lesson?
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard the first of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled, In the Bible, A Judge Named Deborah. Introducing Professor Wiesel was Boston University President Emeritus John Silber. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Mark Liam Bruni. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.